Good morning, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to RTP Live from Chicago in the ASCO meeting. As today we focus on the management of colorectal cancer, we have a great faculty today, Dr. Scott Kopitz from the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, and Dr. John Strickler from the Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. We know a lot of people end up listening to our programs. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today program, a podcast including a recent program on colorectal cancer. This is the seventh of nine programs. Tonight we'll be doing a big program on metastatic breast cancer, and then tomorrow morning I'll be back again live from ASCO talking about bispecific antibodies in lymphoma, including what's being presented here. But today we're here to talk about colorectal cancer. We're trying out this sort of right from ASCO format. There's even some colorectal presentations that are going on today that we haven't seen. Of course, as always, we will be talking about non-approved uses of agents and regimens. Check out the prescribing information for these products. So basically, we have set this up into two parts. We're going to go through a number of major advances in the management of this disease, of course, strictly biomarker-based therapy. And each faculty member is going to give a very brief talk reviewing the topic that we've given to them. But in addition to that, we also did a survey of 50 general medical oncologists over the last couple weeks about a number of our ASCO programs. We asked them for cases, we asked them for questions, and we're going to bring those up to you in a second as we get into it. So, John, we're going to start out in a second, and one of the first topics you're going to talk about is the use of circulating DNA, something you've had a major, involvement with over the years. We got a ton of cases, John, of people using cell, as you're not surprised, I'm sure. We got stage two, we got stage three, we got oligometastatic, all the questions that I know everybody's been asking you, John. Any thoughts? It's just amazing how quickly this strategy has moved into practice. And the other thing I see is oncologists asking about in other cancers, breast cancer, where they don't have the kind of data that we have here with colorectal and the breast cancer. People are going, hold on, hold on, hold on. And the oncologists are going, well, this works in colon. Any sort of broad perspective about how this has evolved? To me, it's been really lightning, John.
Yeah, I think this is important technology. It's a case where the technology maybe has gotten out in front of the evidence a little bit. There's clearly an unmet need for this type of technology, and increasingly you're seeing physicians incorporate the data into their practice where sometimes the trials can't answer every single clinical question we have in front of us.
So, Scott, I'm curious, the trials are focusing on adjuvant therapy, and John's going to talk about that. A lot of cool things are presented here at this meeting. But, we also see, again, a lot of cases of oligometastatic disease. Any thoughts about using this kind of strategy in that kind of situation, particularly post, local therapy to look, as an heightened way to do a surveillance, Scott?
Absolutely. The same data that we're seeing in stage two and three also applies in a resected stage four. Obviously, as John mentioned, we are looking for the data to figure out, are there novel therapies that we can use in this space, or how do we best deploy adjuvant setting even in the oligometastatic? So a lot of questions unanswered, but clearly a really powerful tool.
So, John, in a second, after you go through your talk, we'll talk about some of the papers being presented at ASCO, some of the trials in progress, but also just want to raise in general the issue of MSI-high. And, one thing about MSI-high, John, is really interesting because, since the pandemic, we've recorded, I think, almost 4,000 cases of various cancers from docs in practice. And it's just so great to see them present. Most of them have two or three people who've, even going past, they stopped their IO. Metastatic colorectal cancer that maybe is cured. I mean, an incredible experience. And now they're asking about how long IO, cell-free DNA. Again, John, we'll get into some of the details on the trials, but any sort of global perspective of how this has impacted the oncologists and the community?
Yeah, I think this is a complete game changer for patients with MSI-high colorectal cancer. We were part of some of the original studies with CheckMate 142 with MSI-high disease, and it's impressive to see that these patients will generally stop their immune therapy after a couple of years. They remain disease-free now approaching a decade, and this is for people who came in very sick from high burden of disease. So it's a wonderful advancement for our patients. I know it's exciting for all the oncologists, and also creates some challenges. How do I do surveillance for these patients? How long do I do surveillance? These are the survivorship issues we're now facing, which we never would even consider before a decade ago.
So, audience, this happens so often that, I spend about a half an hour with the faculty, just talking to them before we get started. And I always hear things where I go, why did I not hear this 3 years ago? So I'm going to bring something up they told me. Maybe every single person on this call has heard it except me. I just was not aware of it. I was shocked. So, Scott, can you talk a little bit about what we were talking about before about this phenomenon? I was saying, well, why does not, you hear these cases of people who don't respond. And then you guys were saying, well, a lot of these people have stable disease and the disease looks the same. And you go in there and there's no active disease. The cell-free DNA is negative. And that this is specific to MSI-high metastatic, Scott?
Yes, we do see this, certainly. And it is it's a point of anxiety, understandably, because you have patients that are doing remarkably well after a year or two of immunotherapy with MSI-high. But the disease isn't gone. There's still lesions that are present. And the question always arises, is it okay to stop? And our reassurance is always yes, that we have series where we've gone and done surgery of those lesions to resect, and really it's fibrosis, some mucin deposits sometimes, but they're very rarely is there actually viable tumor left in those areas. So we always reassure and say, just watch, but it's okay to stop treatment.
So like I said, I don't know, maybe this is on the boards, maybe everybody knows it, but I thought it was very interesting and obviously incredibly practical. One other thing, just again, sort of just as a lead-in, John, is the issue that really has taken off in the last couple of years and makes so much sense and really ties in to so many principles in oncology, and that is neoadjuvant immunotherapy and people with IOs. There's going to be, I think, an update today, actually, the Memorial experience. That was, I think, the thing that really started to get people's attention, the rectal cancer series, but now you're hearing upper GI, et cetera. John, where do you see neoadjuvant immunotherapy heading for IOs?
Yes, certainly for an MSI-high cancer, we are seeing a paradigm shift in how we manage these patients. I'll show the data from the Memorial Sloan Kettering experience, but there are a few unique properties to MSI-high cancers. One of those unique properties is that they are generally chemotherapy-resistant cancers. They don't respond as well as, say, a typical microsatellite stable, and they're exquisitely sensitive to immunotherapy, which, of course, we'll go over some of that data. And it raises questions about whether they need an entirely different treatment pathway than a conventional microsatellite stable colon cancer. And I think increasingly what we're seeing is the data bears out that these patients, in many cases, just need immune therapy. In some cases, don't need radiation for rectal cancer, don't need surgery. A challenge in colon cancer is the cure rate's pretty high in general for MSI-high colon cancer, and now we're seeing a lot of path CRs, which I'll show you briefly. And the question is, do they need surgery at all for colon cancer as well? So these are the challenges we're grappling with right now because they are so exquisitely sensitive to immune therapy.
So, John, actually, your colleague at Duke, Angela Secord, was my guest moderator last night, and we were talking about, endometrial cancer last night, MSI-high there, and they're giving chemo plus. Right now they're giving chemo plus IO. But, Scott, you hear this thing about, that MSI-high is not as sensitive to chemo. I mean, I heard that. I remember hearing that about, 5-FU adjuvantly, but how is that really true, that it really doesn't work, Oxali, et cetera?
It still has some efficacy for adjuvant. The kind of FOLFOX can be used in a stage 3. You're right, there was some older data that suggested that in several randomized studies that 5-FU alone shouldn't be used in the adjuvant setting for MSI-high just because of the data suggesting that it was detrimental even in those patients. We do know in metastatic disease, chemotherapy for MSI-high doesn't give you as durable a response as you see in MSS disease. So there is a role, but I think, like John mentioned, our goal in the future is to try to move away from chemotherapy, at least alone in this patient population.
I mean, oncologists love to use targeted therapy, but, you know, we were talking Friday night in terms of EGFR, in terms of whether or not either they're sensitive or not, and, you know, it's really a tough thing to figure out. So let's move on now, and John, we'll talk about some of the data.
Great. Thank you so much, Neil. So starting first with recent therapeutic advances in colorectal cancer, so just some high-level points. We've just spoken about this new technology entering the clinic somewhat ahead of the evidence. So MRD, molecular residual disease testing, it's a validated prognostic tool. I will show you some of that data. An increasing challenge is what to do with a positive result. What do I do next? And I'll talk a little bit about how we're increasingly approaching that. And we'll also discuss, I think, some very important trials that are ongoing and upcoming to explore some escalation, de-escalation strategies. I'll talk about immune checkpoint inhibitors and how they are showing incredibly effective results in patients with MSI-high, non-metastatic colorectal cancer, and then discuss this CheckMate 8HW, which I believe establishes ipilimumab and nivolumab for MSI-high metastatic colorectal cancer. So let's start with this concept of MRD. Sometimes it's described as minimal residual disease, other times molecular residual disease. It's the same concept. It's this idea that you can discover the presence of the cancer before it becomes clinically detectable. And there are a few assays that are now available to us in the clinic. One is the so-called tumor-informed approach, and the other is a plasma-only approach. Now, ultimately, what we're looking for is, as physicians who treat colon cancers, whether we can integrate this MRD testing into our clinical care, specifically selecting high-risk patients for aggressive therapy when we maybe might have not given it, and finding those low-risk patients who maybe can skip chemotherapy entirely. And so that's where we're going with this technology. And some of the most complete data set that we've seen comes from Japan, the so-called GALAXY trial, which was an observational study now with about 3,000 patients worth of data across the stages, but primarily stage 2 and 3. And now they've updated their data at ASCO GI with 16 months of follow-up. The first question is the impact of a single blood draw immediately after surgery, the so-called MRD window. And they use the tumor-informed Signatera test and basically ask the question, what's the prognostic impact of a single negative result or a single positive result immediately after surgery? And you can see here on the right, for those patients who were negative once after surgery, 24-month disease-free survival at 86%, where a positive went all the way down to 29%. And that's off one blood draw in the immediate postoperative period. They then looked at this so-called surveillance window. So this is after that immediate postoperative period is over, either after a chemotherapy, after adjuvant chemotherapy, or after 12 weeks, whichever was later. And here they looked at the performance of this tumor-informed assay over time. And for patients across all stages who remain negative during the surveillance window, 94% 24-month disease-free survival compared to only 6% if a positive was picked up in that window. So very powerful prognostic assay. So right now, especially for stage 2 disease, it's unclear whether we need to give chemotherapy or not, and we're using all of these clinicopathologic features, and the question is, could we use circulating tumor DNA, MRD, to guide our potential management in this setting? One of the most important studies we have to date comes to us from Australia, the Dynamic study. This was presented 2 years ago here at ASCO, published in New England Journal. This took patients with stage 2 colon cancer, completely resected, and they were randomized 2-to-1 to a ctDNA-guided management group or a standard management group. Standard management is the traditional use of clinical pathologic criteria to decide whether you give chemotherapy or not. ctDNA-guided management used a tumor-informed assay, and if the patient was positive, they got chemotherapy. If they were negative, they did not, regardless of the clinical pathologic features. Primary endpoint was relapse-free survival. And we can see a couple important points here. First, for those patients who got ctDNA-guided management, they were half as likely to get adjuvant chemotherapy, much less use of chemotherapy. But those patients who got chemotherapy were far more likely to get an aggressive oxaliplatin-based doublet. When we look at the relapse-free survival, even though those patients in the ctDNA-guided management were less likely to get chemotherapy, relapse-free survival was the same at 2 years. So it did not jeopardize two-year relapse-free survival to get less chemotherapy. So important data. Now I'll give a shout-out to Scott and his team at MD Anderson. This is the INTERCEPT study, a large, very large institutional data set where they once again used the tumor-informed assay from Signatera and asked a couple of very important questions. First, if you have a positive result, are you likely to see something on a scan at the same time? And they found it's about a 50-50. 50% of patients had something evident on scan at the same time, 50 did not. And one of the challenges we have, now at MD Anderson, INTERCEPT did a wonderful job of routing those patients to trials, but most of us don't have access to trials. So what do I do with a positive result? Where is that cancer? It's something that we're all asking right now. And we now have some data sets to start figuring out what that means to have a positive result but a negative scan. ctDNA positive in the dynamic rectal study, which was presented in January, about 80% of those patients had liver disease. However, for those who were negative and had a recurrence, meaning the test did not pick up the recurrence, about 80% of them had lung disease. So what we're learning is this is a powerful tool for detecting especially liver metastases, but also lymph node metastases, sometimes ovarian metastases. And interestingly, Pegasus, this was a study done in Europe with the plasma-only assay, stage 2-3 colon cancer. Just want to direct your attention to the right. For those patients, there were 22 relapses. Some were ctDNA negative, some were positive. 12 of the relapses were in ctDNA positive, and among those patients with liver metastases, all of them had ctDNA detected. Among those with lung metastases, none of them had ctDNA detected. So for me, when I get a positive result on MRD, the first place I'm going to look is the liver, because a lot of our evidence is telling us that that's where you can find it. Circulate US, we'll talk about this a little bit more. This is a very important study on how to use this data in the clinic. They've got cohort A, which is a very important question around de-escalating treatment for those patients who are negative. So patients are randomized between standard chemotherapy or just surveillance. Cohort B are for those patients who are high-risk stage 2 or stage 3 where ctDNA is detected. And there it's an escalation question. Can you potentially improve outcomes by escalating to FOLFOXIRI as opposed to the standard of care of the CAPOX FOLFOX doublet?
So before you go on, just to take a breath with all your great stuff, you know what the first question is that came in? This is from Bertha in the chat room. The first question that came in, of course, was, what do you all think about the TransMet trial? So we're going to get to that for sure. Liver transplantation and metastatic disease. We're going to get there, Bertha. But just to get back to, both of you said this is the thing everybody's going to be asking about. You're totally correct. But getting back to cell-free DNA, Scott, you know, again, when we looked at these cases that the oncologists are sending in, they're already doing these strategies that are in these trials with stage three. Some people have the idea that, you know, if something's being studied in a trial, if you can access that type of strategy, it's, you know, ethical to consider it. Do you yourself, I'm sure you're trying to put everybody you can in a trial, are you yourself using it in patients, older patients, et cetera, with stage three disease?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, the studies in stage two, as John mentioned, really, I think that's the use case that we're seeing the use most commonly right now. And I think that's where we're practicing as the studies have wrapped up in that space. So this idea to say when you're really at equipoise about escalation, that's probably the strength of the ctDNA data at the moment. And I think the de-escalation questions really encourage people to wait until we have that clinical data. So the idea of should we be withholding adjuvant therapy or should we be doing less adjuvant therapy? I think that that I really encourage us to get that data first.
Yeah, and the more educated the patient, the trickier this becomes. I mean, there are oncologists who are patients like this. And actually, another great question, we were talking about this before we started today, too, from Cavi, this issue of treating based on cell-free DNA detected recurrence as opposed to a clinical imaging detected recurrence. Is that a reasonable inference to make? I was mentioning to the two of you that in a way it kind of reminds me, we're going to talk tonight in our breast cancer session, there's a trial that watches people on hormonal therapy and they develop ESR1 mutations. I know that's different than cell-free DNA, but it is a liquid signal, so to speak. So they're randomized between switching based on that. It's kind of similar to what Cavi's bringing up here. Scott, any thoughts about whether or not, you can treat it's basically like treating PSA recurrence for that matter too in prostate cancer.
Right. And I think we're encouraging a lot of development in this space because we really think this is an opportunity to improve outcomes and survival in patients. So I think if we can bring, novel therapies here over the next few years to improve therapies and improve that cure rate, that's the real goal. We think that things like FOLFIRI or starting cytotoxic chemotherapy may be delaying time to radiographic recurrence, but then you have one less line of therapy when the disease appears radiographically. So it's not completely clear that we're benefiting the patients by doing early standard of care therapy.
So we're getting the chat room all juiced up here. I think I better hold off and let John get back to MSI high because they're just like flooding in here all of a sudden with cell-free DNA questions. But let's get the PD-1 stuff out there. I'm hoping someday we're going to be talking about MS-stable disease, but at least there's something exciting in terms of MSI. So, John, take it away.
Yeah, we've had a stunning paradigm shift for MSI-high colorectal cancer. I think probably one of the most important data sets comes to us from a Memorial Sloan Kettering experience. The study design is shown here. Here, Dr. Sirsik and her team took a group of patients with locally advanced rectal cancer where the standard of care is chemoradiation followed by chemotherapy followed by surgery and asked the question of whether you could skip all that in a patient with MSI-high disease and just give immune therapy here to dostarlimab. And to summarize it all, nothing summarizes it better than this slide. Her first 12 patients she put on, all of them had complete clinical responses. There was no chemoradiotherapy or surgery required for these patients. She went on to update this data a little bit. We'll see a significant update today. But this was practice-changing for us. This is now in our NCCN guidelines for those patients who have MSI-high rectal cancer that's locally advanced. Anti-PD-1 therapy is a new standard of care for us. Well-tolerated, highly effective. There's other contexts where we've seen impressive data for neoadjuvant therapies. This comes to us from the MD Anderson group, Mike Overman and his team over there. This was a phase 2 open-label study of pembrolizumab for 6 months in patients with MSI-high solid tumors. 27 of these patients had colorectal cancer. I'll direct your attention to the waterfall plot. This is radiographic response. Overall response rate, 82%. 14 patients with colon cancer went on to get surgery, pathologic complete response rate of 79%. Once again, very impressive data. Then, of course, we have Niche 1, which was published in 2020 from Dr. Chalabi and her team. This took patients with resectable colon cancer that was, in most cases, MSI-high. I'll go over the microsatellite stable group here in a moment. But the question was just a simple feasibility and safety question. If you give a single dose of ipilimumab and two doses of nivolumab before surgery, what's the impact on those patients? For the 20 patients who had MSI-high or deficient mismatch repair tumors, 20 out of 20 tumors had a pathologic response. 12 patients had a pathologic CR. They also did a smaller data set here with proficient mismatch repair, microsatellite stable. And this is a group of patients where we don't expect to see much in the way of response, but even in that group, 4 out of 15 patients had a pathologic response. Very intriguing data. Dr. Chalabi followed that up with Niche 2, which was presented at in 2022 at the ESMO Congress. And here, treated, once again, one dose of Ipi, two doses of nivolumab before surgery, 107 patients worth of data. Very impressive data. 95% of patients had a major pathologic response. In fact, 2/3 of all patients had a path CR. So that, of course, leads into the metastatic setting, where we initially saw the data from CheckMate 8HW at ASCO GI in January. We had an update yesterday. This randomizes patients to either single agent nivolumab, all patients are MSI high, frontline, so untreated, randomized to nivolumab, ipi-nivo, or investigator choice chemotherapy, primary endpoint being progression-free survival, and really just a stunning Kaplan-Meier plot. Progression-free survival significantly in favor of the ipi-nivo group as compared to cytotoxic chemotherapy, hazard ratio at 0.21 in favor of ipi-nivo. So this, I think, establishes this treatment as a another standard of care treatment option for these patients with MSI-high colorectal cancer. But of course, we always need to be mindful of these treatment-related adverse events. And I will point out that there were 2 deaths on the ipi-nivo arm related to immune therapy, so 1% of patients enrolled. So we always need to be careful when we're giving these therapies to ensure that the toxicity is well managed and recognized.
So a couple of practical questions that come out of some of the things that you were just talking about. First one, getting back to the chat room and cell-free DNA. Priya Rudolph was one of the docs who worked in our program on GYN last night. She says she has a patient with a slowly rising ctDNA level post resection of oligolung met. Scott, scans are NED, other liver MRI is also normal. Can you justify instituting treatment just based on this assay, Scott?
Yeah, the positive predictive value of these is incredibly high with the, you know, the tumor-informed assays. So in that setting, I think this kind of awkward situation where we can say with some degree of certainty there's disease there, but also acknowledging that we don't know that initiating therapy early will improve outcomes for the patient. These are hard conversations with the patients to kind of talk through that. And in our practice, obviously, we try to get patients on clinical trials, and there's a number of those. I will just mention there's a community website that has a bunch of these trials on it, so that's a crcmrd.org website. So, you know, you can look and to see if there's something nearby. But otherwise, you know, that discussion about, you know, do you just start some low-dose capecitabine as a maintenance or otherwise, certainly these are hard decisions and discussions with patients.
So I'm going to ask you the tough question to both of you in terms of your general preferred first-line systemic therapy or MSI-high disease, particularly in younger patients. But before we get to that, just to get back to you, John. In terms of the Memorial rectal study, I think I've heard people say that maybe rectal MSI high might be different in terms of, I don't know, the somatic or germline split. Is there anything different about MSI rectal that would make it more sensitive to IO than other MSI, for example?
It's a good question. And to my knowledge, there's no fundamental difference between, say, a rectal or a right-sided colon cancer MSI high. There have been hints that perhaps whether this is somatically derived or from a germline alteration, that may have a minor impact. But the basic concept is the same. MSI-high cancers have very high mutational load. They will generate tumor neoantigens, create an inflamed tumor microenvironment, and are exquisitely sensitive to an immunotherapy type of therapy.
So, Scott, you've got this hazard rate of 0.21. You don't see that every day. And the question of, you know, do we really need CTLA-4? You know, obviously, it'd be great to have a direct comparison. You can comment. I think there is a little bit of data now maybe available of whether CTLA-4 adds to that. And again, and maybe a consideration of younger patients. Kind of reminds me a little bit of renal, where they try to decide between Ipi-Nivo and TKI-IO, and they don't have direct evidence, but they kind of looks like the responses are longer. They get people who can handle Ipi-Nivo. That's what they give them. Is that kind of where you're at right now, or is it convincing enough indirectly that if you have a patient you think can get through it, you're going to do it, Scott?
It is to me. I think, you know, we obviously await the randomized data, the CheckMate 8HW, but I think it's going to be a year or two at least until we see that, just the low event rates in that population. So I think we have to work with the data that we have, and that's cross-trial, as John mentioned, certainly. I will call out that there was a fairly large randomized neoadjuvant study that was done. So again, neoadjuvant, but this was PD-1 plus or minus CTLA-4 and showed for the first time that the addition of CTLA-4 did substantially increase path CR rates. So I think that combined with the cross-trial comparisons is compelling enough for me in my practice to do a doublet from the start.
And I feel like every day we're talking about involving patients in decisions that they want to be, and here's another example. John, again, are you sort of favoring the Ipi-Nivo approach at this point?
It really is a difficult question right now. So many of us have had great experiences with the KEYNOTE-177 regimen and pembrolizumab. One of the concerns that we have about single agent anti-PD-1, if you look at KEYNOTE-177, in the first 4 months, there's a big drop off on the pembrolizumab arm. So about 30% of patients will have rapid progression on single agent PD-1. If you go back to the, so this is what we shouldn't be doing, cross-trial comparisons, but if you go back to the CheckMate 8HW data, you don't see quite as steep a drop-off. And one of the concerns that I have when I face this in the clinic is if somebody has a very high burden of disease and you're worried about organ compromise from that disease, you know, can that patient afford to have a rapid progression in the first 2 to 4 months? So I think sometimes you'll hear us talk about giving Ipi-Nivo in a high burden of disease state where a response is important. I think the other flip side of it, though, is that we know that the addition of the CTLA-4 comes with a significant added toxicity. And there was 1% fatality rate out of CheckMate 8HW. And the last thing you would want to do is have a treatment-related fatality where that patient would have had a long-term durable response with single-agent anti-PD-1. So it's something we're really weighing. I'd love to see that nivolumab arm come out of CheckMate 8HW so I can better understand just how much of a benefit you're really getting by addition of CTLA-4, and it's not clear yet.
So getting back to hot news, Scott, and this trial, the TransMet trial, when I saw this, I'm like, that's interesting, liver transplant, metastatic disease. So, I mean, they had not that many patients, but it looked like there's a survival benefit. I mean, you think people are going to consider doing it? Have you ever done this, Scott?
So we have on protocols, and there is a modest effort in the U.S. In piecemeal fashion to explore this. What they showed was that in the very narrow population of patients that had liver only metastatic disease, but that was unresectable by more by traditional surgery. And had a lot of, obviously, performance status, comorbidity, restrictions, and the ability to really control the disease for a prolonged period of time, that those patients were eligible for randomization. And it showed improved survival in that population. Even though recurrence in the transplanted patients was fairly high, more than two-thirds of patients did have recurrence of disease, but the survival signal was still seen.
So one other paper, John, I guess giving some reassurance to docs in practice that surgery, you can approach this with thermal ablation for metastatic disease equally effective. They actually did a phase 3 trial. Anything you want to say about that, John?
I actually think this is an important study. we are fortunate at our centers. We have access to hepatobiliary surgeons who are quite comfortable resecting hepatic metastatic disease. Occasionally, patients are seen at centers where maybe it's more difficult to access that type of surgical support. So the question is, can thermal ablation or radiofrequency ablation be used as a substitute for surgery? And the answer here is yes. You can comfortably refer that patient for thermal ablation. You don't always need a surgeon to target these hepatic metastases. And it's an important data set for us.
So we're going to move on now and go into Scott's topics, particularly HER2 and KRAS G12C. But just as a punctuation point to our discussion, Kavya in the let me read what the comment here from Kavya in the chat room. I have patients with cancer. I think this is about CTLA-4. I have patients with cancer in remission but develop type 1 diabetes, mm-hmm. panhypophysitis, hypothyroid, pneumonitis, and pericarditis. Feels miserable and say it's worse than the cancer. Something to think about. Certainly is something to think about. What a tough decision it really is. But, you know, again, if you have a patient who's interested in being involved, now's the time to just lay it out to them and let them help make you the decision. All right, Scott, we're going to talk about particularly HER2. Of course, we have the wild. I mean, not that it was surprising, but when I saw that, I'm like, oh, my gosh, here we go. Pan-tumor approval, IHC 3+. God, who even knows how that's going to translate to HER2 mutations, HER2 low. We're just, you know, getting warned. We already have been in it with you guys already and the lung people, but now everybody's in board. And, of course, oncologists have a million questions about what to do in this situation. A lot of questions about your Mountaineer regimen, John. What comes first, that or TDXD? The kinds of questions we hear all the time. KRAS, everybody seems to have a patient where they've been treated with either one of the agents. Of course, people want to know which one, what you're doing, how you manage side effects, et cetera. So that's just a little bit of a prelude to some of the clinical things we're going to get into with Scott's talk. I'm really curious about both of these topics, Scott. So why don't we just go ahead and get started?
Wonderful. Well, thanks so much. Just to put this in context, what we'll be talking about is the HER2 3+ amplified population, 2-4% overall, as well as that kind of rare subset of KRAS G12Cs, probably about 3%. But I think really important lessons more broadly. To look at the HER2 first, the Mountaineer study, as you mentioned, this is John's work. This is what really led to the understanding of tucatinib trastuzumab. Just an important point here, these are RAS wild-type patients that were HER2 either by IHC or amplified by NGS. And showed very impressive responses. You can see the waterfall plots here. And this really then became an important standard of care. The safety profile, some GI fatigue, and you can see the other ones, but I think ones that we feel fairly comfortable now in managing and have not been a big impact on the quality of life. The other agent, as mentioned, is the trastuzumab deruxtecan, now approved as well. This was the data for colorectal cancer, the DESTINY CRC study. This had cohorts of the 3+ or amplified 2+ there as well. This was initially done in the RAS wild type here as well, but additional data has been accumulated. You can see the responses shown here. Really confirmed response rate of 45% by Bicker. So very similar numerically to the trastuzumab tucatinib experience. The CRC O2 study then took that finding and looked at randomizing those patients to either the low or what's now considered the high dose. The 5.4 is what's moved forward. These are patients that were allowed now to have RAS mutations. So unlike the CRC 01, the 02 did include the RAS, and this is now how we practice, as we'll show. So the data, again, confirm that high response rate. The progression-free survival data here is 5.8. The response by BICR, 38%. And importantly, as you can see maybe in that third line down, that the RAS status was not a major major impact to the extent that it was a subgroup analysis there. So gave some reassurance, as we would expect by the first principles of an ADC with a topoisomerase, that we can administer this in a RAS population. The side effect profile, hematologic predominantly, some nausea, fatigue. And as a class effect of the topoisomerase ADCs, there are interstitial lung disease, ILD, that is seen. And that was seen at the higher dose that is not what is currently recommended, but the rates are still there. You can see that there's some any grade pneumonitis, but no grade 3 or above in the 5.4.
So, yeah, let's just sort of bring a few practical issues up. And I was referring to testing, John. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can just sort of comment a little bit about HER2 testing. And one of the things you hear about that to me is confusing is so-called, I think, gastric-type approach and breast-type approach. Can you explain what the difference is and what you do with colorectal cancer, where we are right now with, for example, TDXD, and how does this approval affect the use of TDXD? Is it just going to be IHC3+? John, any comments?
Well, sometimes there's a disconnect between the approvals and what actually happens, right? So first comment is that the GI cancers can be blamed for dragging down that approval in a way. Scott, if you look at the pan-tumor experience, the response rates for TDXD across all solid tumors are quite high in IHC2+, except for the GI cancers, colon cancer and biliary tract cancers in particular. That IHC3+ is very important for them. And so what we're really doing in practice is ordering NGS and identifying HER2 amplification from our comprehensive genomic profiling panels. Then if we can access trastuzumab deruxtecan without an IHC test, I suspect we would just treat. But it does appear that if you're going to test, IHC3+ does predict benefit for that particular drug with our GI cancers. That said, which assay do you use? There is no colon-specific IHC assay. There's really just gastric and breast. The breast staining is different. So the breast staining will be circumferential. The gastric staining is just looking basal, lateral, and lateral. The luminal edge does not have HER2 staining. So then the question is, which one do I use? The pathologist may call me up and say, okay, which antibody do you want me to use? And we've looked at this out of Mountaineer. It actually doesn't matter. Whether you use breast or gastric, the result, an IHC3+ will be generally concordant between those two assays. I know, Scott, you've done some work in this space. I tell the pathologist, use whatever you want to, but you rarely, very rarely see discordance between a gastric assay and a breast assay to test HER2 in colon.
Before I ask Scott to comment, again, I'm amazed how many things I guess I just didn't understand. I thought the difference between gastric and breast was like looking for heterogeneity. So you're saying it's a different antibody?
It's a different assay. Go ahead, Scott.
Different assay. Scott?
Yeah. No, there is some issues of how it stains and the heterogeneity. And this is an area that there's been a fair bit of work on the pathology literature to try to understand. It's the so-called TOGA criteria. For example, with gastric. But I think the real take-home message, I think, as John mentioned, is that these are that either methodology, either approach will give you the answers that help identify patients that can benefit. And that while the criteria may be a little different, it's a very rare patient who will be 3+ by one methodology and not by the other. And so I think in a busy oncology practice, I would say I would feel very comfortable, as we do, in just taking whatever methodology is being utilized by your pathologist and using that for colorectal cancer.
Well, that's very helpful and practical, too. So, John, another thing that comes up is HER2 mutations, and they get picked up. I don't know how often you see this with colon cancer, obviously lung cancer, that's a big deal. That's what the initial approval was. Do you ever see HER2 mutations? Would you try to treat that? And are you generally, I mean, do all this applies to both to Mountaineer as well as TDXD, all these testing things?
Yeah, so there's a important difference in the approval between tucatinib, trastuzumab, the Mountaineer regimen, and trastuzumab deruxtecan. The FDA approval for trastuzumab deruxtecan is specifically for IHC3+ disease, but they don't specify in the approval which assay you need to use, whether it's breast or gastric. For the Mountaineer regimen, tucatinib, trastuzumab, it's any HER2-positive result by a validated assay. Could be NGS, could be IHC in fish. So that's an important distinction there. Sorry, to get to your second question?
No, the other thing I was just curious about is, in general, what comes first for you guys, Mountaineer or TDX, assuming you have access to both?
Yeah, I think
maybe Mountaineer, but you tell me.
Yeah, so you had also asked the question about HER2 mutations. That comes
right,
up
HER2
quite a bit.
Right, HER2 mutations, right, exactly.
That's a really important question. It does not appear that that same evidence from lung cancer, where you see profound activity for trastuzumab deruxtecan, also extends into, say, colon cancer. So it does appear that tumor context matters in that respect. Now, you know, in looking at what's been presented publicly, it does appear that there may be some cases where you can generate responses with a HER2 mutant that's not overexpressed, but we don't know exactly whether the type of HER2 mutation matters. One of the things that we're facing now in the clinic is we've got two FDA-approved therapies now, tucatinib and trastuzumab deruxtecan. Which one do I give first? In my practice, and granted I may be biased as the investigator for Mountaineer who authored the trial, but I do think there's real biology here. Tucatinib and trastuzumab, when there's a response, it tends to be quite durable and it's a very favorable tolerability profile. And when patients progress, they rarely lose HER2. In fact, sometimes you'll see upregulation of HER2, but acquisition of some other type of mutation that drives resistance, PIK3CA, RAS mutations. Trastuzumab deruxtecan has the exact same response rate whether a patient has seen trastuzumab or not in the past. And the only thing trastuzumab deruxtecan needs to work is HER2 expression. So it is a perfect, very complementary strategy to start with tucatinib trastuzumab, and at the point of progression, switch over to trastuzumab deruxtecan. The converse is probably not true. The patterns of resistance with trastuzumab deruxtecan are pretty unfavorable for tucatinib trastuzumab. And so I think that to maximize that patient's quality of life and survival, I personally will sequence it tucatinib trastuzumab followed by trastuzumab deruxtecan.
Well, in addition to the biology, there's also the practical issue. You have interstitial lung disease hanging out there that's a little
Correct.
Bit scary. We don't see that with the Mountaineer regimen. So let's move on, and we want to hear about KRAS G12C, but how about a little palate cleanser from the chat room here? One of our chat room stars, Hassan, has a case just before we jump back into the targeted therapy. So, Scott, 45-year-old man with sigmoid cancer at surgery. Part of the tumor is high rectal. 6 positive nodes out of 22, 2 of them in the mesorectal area. Any role for radiation post-op, all margins negative?
Yeah, great question. And it is one of these, these high rectals are an area of real debate. So this is something that there really depends on how high up in the rectum it is, and this is the exact question that we have multiple disciplinary tumor boards to discuss. I'd say increasingly we are withholding radiation just as a general theme at some of these high rectals. I will say that the nodal distribution maybe makes me a little more concerned in this situation, so this may be one of the cases that I would still incorporate radiation, although the trends are less and less radiation.
So let's get back to targeted therapy. I was going to ask you, when I saw this initial layout here for your thing, is there some overall message here in the way you have it laid out, or is it just different colors?
Yes, so it is, that there are some of these that overlap. The MSI high overlaps with the BRAF and the fusions.
Yeah, okay, got it. Yeah.
The HER2s have both a mutated and a wild type subpopulation.
Right.
So,
I get it.
Yeah, a little bit of a method to the madness, perhaps.
I like it. Yeah, I knew it meant something. I just couldn't figure it out. Now I get it. That's great.
Yeah.
All right.
So, and this is Dr. Rogoff's figure, so we'll have to give him, let him know that that was appreciated. But the, so G12C sits down as a small subset of our RAS mutations, but it really represents kind of the first crack in the wall of KRAS. The undruggable is now druggable. This is based on the identification of a switch II pocket, so this is separate. So normally we think about, kinase inhibitors displacing GTP or ATP. That's not what is happening here. It's actually binding in a separate location in the in KRAS. And this then is a, importantly, these are covalent inhibitors. So they bind and covalently to the cysteine. It's a wonderful, wonderful chemistry. This is a very common theme for those of us in colorectal cancer. We tend to have a tumor type that doesn't respond as well to these single agents. And this is the sotorasib data, just showing the response in lung cancer and colorectal as the first out of the gate. The recognition and I can't help throwing a Western blot or two every so often, so apologies for that. But this is, I think the key message here is that when you combine a G12C and an EGFR together, that's when you really shut down the pathway. So if you are looking at the Western blots, that far right, phospho-ERK is the readout. You just don't see any signaling with the combination. And this is the idea of adaptive resistance. You block one node and the tumor responds by upregulating signaling through EGFR, even though we know that EGFR is not a biologically important node to inhibit alone, right? Because we say we don't treat with EGFR inhibitors in the presence of the KRAS mutation. But here we're inducing this adaptive effort. So this is the data from the CodeBreaK 300 study. We're going to get important overall survival updates today at ASCO. This was looking at the dose optimization as well. And in 960, this is the dose that's utilized. You can see the response rates in the randomized study. Much steeper drop-off at the 240 dose with lower response rates. The other inhibitor, adagrasib cetuximab, the KRYSTAL-1 study that was reported out at AACR. This was then the data set that with adagrasib cetuximab combination that's under review with the FDA currently. And we're anticipating a little later this month to hear back from the FDA on this. Here's the best change from baseline. So you can see the response rate here, 34%, and a disease control rate of 85%, and the PFS of 6.9 months. So clearly providing some benefit for our patients as well. There are other inhibitors, divarasib and others, that are coming down the pike and have additional data. So a lot of really exciting areas here. And the G12Cs, like the adagrasib, sotorasib, really are providing the roadmap for the other RAS inhibitors that are coming. And we're seeing G12D inhibitors now, as well as pan-RAS or pan-KRAS inhibitors coming into clinic. So the future is bright for targeting KRAS. So I think as we talked about, the trastuzumab tucatinib for HER2, really in the RAS wild type only, and I completely agree with John about sequencing that and following the doublet targeted therapy with the ADC. And then I think we've got a lot of opportunities coming with the KRAS inhibitors.
So let's just leave that slide up there, because I wanted to just to pick up on some of the practical issues involved here. And I want to start out with the patients with KRAS G12C. John, in terms of quality of life, prevention and management of side effects, and differences, if any, between these two agents?
Well, I can't speak to the differences between the agents. Most of my experience has been with the sotorasib-panitumab combination. That's due to some quirks of the geography in which I practice in North Carolina, which really limits me to a humanized antibody like panitumab. But I will say, with respect to tolerability, now treating many, many patients with KRAS G12C mutated colon cancer, I've had a very favorable experience with sotorasib. Most of the toxicity you get with that regimen comes from the panitumab, the classic skin rash, hypomagnesemia that we are accustomed to managing now with that combination. What I've found is that the data, in a way, understates the value of the approach. And what I mean by that is, number one, patients tolerate it well, so they can stay on it a long time. But typically, the pattern of resistance would be what I call oligoprogressive disease. Maybe they're under great control for 4 to 6 months, and maybe a small lung nodule emerges, which is a resistant clone. And you'll see a lot of use of these locally directed therapies to keep the patient on that regimen and keep them away from cytotoxic chemotherapy. And I've had some patients, because I was an investigator on CodeBreaK 101 with that original combo, I've had patients stay on that combination for literally years with very good quality of life, very manageable.
That's really helpful to hear. Same question, Bob, back to you, Scott, in terms of differences between the two regimens and your experience in terms of tolerability.
Yeah, I think the tolerability, I'd echo, is really wonderful. And part of that is that incredible specificity and the fact that it's a covalent binding, so there's very little off-target effects of these agents. I will say, as a bit of a warning, that what's coming next in terms of the next round of RAS inhibitors are probably not going to have that same degree of specificity, and there may be higher toxicities that we see with those, and that's part of the challenges of development of the next wave of the RAS inhibitors. But for now, with these inhibitors, these are ones probably some of the best tolerated therapies that we have in colorectal cancer, I would say, from the G12C inhibitors. It's really just the EGFR rash that's there. There's, in terms of comparison, we're really left with, of course, cross-trial comparisons, perhaps numerically adagrasib and cetuximab higher than sotorasib and panitumab. But they all are going to have response rates that kind of settle down and are lower as you go from phase 1 to 2 to 3. It's really, I think the data is just not there to call a winner by efficacy.
So flipping back to HER2 disease, John, curious about tolerability issues with the Mountaineer regimen.
Yeah, I think trastuzumab tucatinib, the goal of that treatment, at least that was as it was originally envisioned, was to find a regimen that patients who are heavily pretreated can tolerate for long periods of time. It's a chemotherapy-free regimen. Trastuzumab we know well. We know the toxicity profile of trastuzumab now for decades. Tucatinib is an oral therapy. It's highly potent, highly selective for HER2. So if you do see side effects from that tyrosine kinase inhibitor, it will tend to be a grade one or grade two diarrhea, occasionally a rash, extremely rare situations where patients may come off for asymptomatic liver function enzyme elevations. But one of the more common adverse events, which we haven't commented on to this point, are which you can see in that plot, is weight gain and hypertension. And that's because when people go on this regimen, they feel so well, they start eating again, they start gaining weight again. It's actually, in that adverse event table, but it's actually a function of well-being that people want to have full steak dinners again and, you know, live their life and start gaining weight back.
Yeah, I was surprised at that. And in a way, I'm kind of surprised at your explanation because, I mean, a lot of cancers, you know, you see remissions, you don't see weight gain. But do you think this is really the case, or do you think it's in some way stimulating appetite? I mean, there are drugs that do that.
Well, in our trial experience, and I know because I enrolled many of these patients, coming in third, fourth line of therapy, many patients are significantly disabled by the burden of their disease and by the cumulative effects of the cytotoxic chemotherapy. Sometimes within days, those patients feel dramatically better, and the appetite picks up, the energy picks up. They start to be the person they were before they were diagnosed. And, so I think that's what you're seeing in that weight gain number is people eating the whole pie again, right? Eating all the things they wanted to eat but lost the taste for because they were on chemotherapy. So it's an exciting option for those patients who do benefit.
One final question about that. Of course, in breast cancer, which we're going to be talking about tonight, incidentally, for our program, we got a lot of great cases from community practice. But there, of course, tucatinib is used particularly in people with brain mets. I guess brain mets are maybe not as common with HER2-positive colorectal, but do you see CNS activity with MOUNTAINEER, John?
Great question. From the original Heracles investigators, which looked at a different TKI combo, specifically lapatinib-trastuzumab, brain metastases were diagnosed in about 1 in 6 patients in their data set. So it is a real problem for HER2-positive colon cancer as well. These tumors do have a tendency to go to the CNS. We did not have many patients progress in the central nervous system on trial. But one of the challenges, we did not mandate a pretreatment brain MRI. So many of these patients eventually were diagnosed with brain metastases, incidentally discovered long after, maybe sometimes even after they were on the tucatinib-trastuzumab regimen. It appears that tucatinib does provide CNS control, but it's only just conjecture because we didn't really study that as part of the trial.
So I don't know who Kavya is, but I hope she comes back to the chat room again. She has another great comment here. She was the one who brought up the issue of CTLA-4. Any work on tumor-agnostic approval for tucatinib? I have a GE cancer progressing on T-DXd, but can't get approval for MOUNTAINEER. Is that a logical thought to try it in HER2-positive gastroesophageal, John?
It's an interesting question. It's something we've looked at. We actually ran a trial of tucatinib, trastuzumab, Taxol, and RAM, so a quadruplet. And the results were encouraging. Right now, it's not being studied. I think one of the challenges we have specific to upper GI cancers is the significant heterogeneity. There's a lot of HER2 loss as those patients go through multiple lines of anti-HER2 therapies. And that's a challenge for a drug like tucatinib, which really is so potent but so selective to HER2. It really does need that HER2 to be active without, the classic RAS mutations around to drive resistance, or in the case of upper GI cancers, there's a lot of copy number aberrations, a lot of amplifications. So I think in that particular case, what I would encourage is actually, if you could rebiopsy the cancer, try to rebiopsy it. Look for things like MET amplification. We do have drugs out there, like, for example, ABV-400, which is very potent against MET amplification, and that's a known driver of resistance to HER2 therapies, particularly for upper GI cancers.
Yeah, there's actually a couple papers we put in there with that new MET ADC, very interesting agent. So John and Scott, thank you so much for working with us today. As always, we learned so much from you. Audience, be safe, stay well, and have a great day. Thanks so much, Scott. Thanks, John.
Thank you.